Hello and welcome to Galaxy Moonbeam Nightsight. We are the retro talk show where we talk about just about everything, anything, and all things having to do with the baby boomer generation and beyond. I'm Mike.
I'm Smitty.
I'm George.
And I am Mike Z.
And sit back and relax, because for the next 60 minutes we're going to bring the past, present, and how they all fit together right to you. And before, or what do they say, without, before, or during... During further ado,
without further ado,
we are going to bring our good friend George Halilakos in to talk to us about a very important subject that we all grew up to, and George has a different take on it this time. George, how are you, bud?
I'm doing great. Great. Mike. Wonderful to be with my good friends here at the Galaxy Moonbeam Nightsight Studio. Today, I wanted to talk about a famous character in fiction that we all know from cinema, but few of us may be aware about. It originally began in the printed page, and I am talking about Tarzan, Tarzan of the Apes. This year marks the centennial, that is the 100th anniversary of the publication of the first Tarzan novel, titled appropriately, Tarzan of the Apes. And what I wanted to do today is that most of us here in the Galaxy Moonbeam Nightside audience are aware of Tarzan through all of the wonderful film and television programs that we have seen, dating back all the way to the 1920s, up into the 21st century. But I wanted to talk about Tarzan as it was originally created by Edgar Rice Burroughs, Tarzan on the printed page, because now you have the opportunity to access all 24 Tarzan novels via digitized format on Nook, and you can also obtain copies in hard form through Ballantine Books. So let's talk about Tarzan and do a synopsis of the 24-book series. Tarzan, as I noted, was created by Edgar Rice Burroughs, and Tarzan is actually known as John Clayton, Lord Greystoke of the United Kingdom, who was reared as an infant into early adulthood by apes after his parents passed away after having been marooned on the west coast of Africa. Tarzan is self-taught in the English language, having studied the books that were left behind in the cabin formerly occupied by his deceased parents. And in the first two novels released by Edgar Rice Burroughs, we witness how Tarzan learns of his British heritage, how he meets and eventually marries Jane Porter of Baltimore, Maryland. And then the story continues in the third and fourth novels, with the focus shifting towards Korak, who is the son of Tarzan. And it talks about his kidnapping, his rescue, and later how he meets and marries his eventual wife, Miriam. In novel number 5, titled Tarzan and the Jewels of Opar, Tarzan has further adventures in an ancient city that was encountered in the prior novel, that turns out to be the remnants of the lost continent of Atlantis. And this marked the beginning of a recurring theme that we would find throughout the entire Tarzan series, that is, of finding and often returning to lost civilizations from yesteryear that we associate either with great novels or great films. The city of Opar is revisited again in novels number 9 and 14, Tarzan and the Golden Lion and Tarzan the Invincible. Other lost cities that were part of the Tarzan series, including Strange Lands, are featured in Tarzan number 10, Tarzan and the Ant-Men, in which we are able to read about the Edgar Rice Burroughs version of Gulliver's Travels, featuring miniature warriors in deepest dark Africa that capture the Lord of the Jungle. Tarzan 11, appropriately titled Tarzan, Lord of the Jungle, our hero encounters remnants of European knights from medieval times. In Tarzan number 12, The Lost Empire, he finds a remnant of the Roman Empire. Tarzan number 13 takes a science fiction twist. It's titled Tarzan at the Earth's Core. And this is essentially the Edgar Rice Burroughs version of Jurassic Park, which was briefly touched upon in number 8, in which our hero of the jungle encounters prehistoric creatures from a bygone era. In Tarzan number 15, he encounters a religious cult. In Tarzan 16 and number 21, titled Tarzan and the City of Gold, and then later Tarzan the Magnificent, he encounters the two lost cities of Kathni and Athni, which trace their origins to both ancient Greco-Roman civilizations. And then in Tarzan's 17 and 18, he encounters secret societies, respectively titled Tarzan and the Lion Man and Tarzan and the Leopard Man. But what is not well known, and I think it's a linchpin to the entire series, is Tarzan number 19, which should be of great interest to everyone that has an interest in this particular fictional hero. Tarzan's Quest is a very important novel because Tarzan and his wife Jane and their companions are able to find an immortality drug. And this provides the basis of why Tarzan does not age, as he is actively depicted fighting in both world wars. In World War I, that is in Tarzan number 7, Tarzan the Untamed, and Tarzan number 8, The Terrible, both of these take place in Africa. And then later in Tarzan number 22, my personal favorite, he is fighting in the South Pacific against the Japanese in a novel titled Tarzan and the Foreign Legion that was released in 1947. So we see here a long timeline beginning in 1912, continuing into 1947. And then interestingly enough, the final two Tarzan novels in the series were released posthumously in 1964 and 65, as Burroughs had passed away in the year 1950. The ancient civilization theme continued with number 20, in which it was titled Tarzan and the Forbidden City. And here, Tarzan is able to find the largest diamonds in the world. And here we venture into the world of the paranormal, because it turns out that these diamonds are also to impart to the possessor mind control powers. Then later, we had some anthologies, that is, collections of short stories that were featured in Tarzan number 6, The Jungle Tales, and then number 24, which was the final version, titled Tarzan and the Castaways. The imposter theme was addressed in Tarzan number 9, The Golden Lion, and also number 23, The Madman. I should also add that there were two books written for juveniles or children titled The Tarzan Twins. And it's not an official part of the 24-book series, but it's very popular with young readers. I finally want to mention here that there's a great book that was released in 1995 that was based actually on an unfinished Burroughs manuscript that was finally completed with the approval of the Burroughs estate, and it tells us what happens to our hero. It's titled The Lost Adventure. And what we find out is that Tarzan returns to the Earth's core. As you noted earlier, he had visited the Earth's core in number 13, and now it creates a whole new timeline of adventures, because what happens at the end of this book is that Tarzan finds himself trapped with no way to return to the surface world and no way to return to his former life with his wife, Jane. And so it leaves us here with our hero wandering off into the inner world of Pellucidar and creating an opportunity for perhaps some new fan fiction to be introduced. Anyway, it's a great, great series. And while the movies and the television series are great adventures, I think that our Galaxy Moonbeam Nightside audience would enjoy visiting now the novels that made these television series and movies possible.
George, if anybody has any real interest in Tarzan, what would you suggest? Would you suggest reading one of the novels first before watching some of the movies? Say somebody who wants to study Edgar Rice Burroughs and learn about Tarzan, what would you suggest?
Well, there have been, of course, a number of books written in the last 10 to 15 years titled Tarzan, The Greystoke Legacy, published in 2011, Tarzan, The Jungle Warrior in 2012. Those would be some great places to start if you want to just get a feel for the entire series. But what I think is wonderful is that for less than $5, you can go on to Barnes & Noble and you can download the entire 24-book series that I just ran through for less than $5. I know, because I have that now. And it's a lot easier than trying to find hard copies through your library or through rare bookstores. And I think if you do that, you'll find it to be a lot of fun. And it's very, very easy reading, fast-paced, well-written, a lot of adventure, and I think that would be a lot of fun as well.
That's right, George, and I would imagine that some of those early editions are quite the collector's item.
They very much are, and in fact, yours truly is very fortunate to have a couple of first editions, my personal favorite being Tarzan and the Foreign Legion. Mr. Burroughs had his own publishing company in Tarzana, California, And he published those books under his own company. And if you can find those books with the original dust jackets like I have, it's a wonderful, wonderful treasure.
You just mentioned Tarzana. Is that obviously that has a tie-in with Tarzana?
It obviously does. It turns out that Mr. Burroughs lived on a ranch in the San Fernando Valley, and he lived there and worked there for many years, raised his family there. And then eventually, years after his passing, it was turned into, I guess, an office complex that is there now. And I think it's still owned by the Burroughs family. And yes, the city of Tarzana was named to honor its most famous resident, who happened to be a fictional hero.
That's great.
But Tarzan represents so very much, and I think he is perennially relevant because he is strong, he is brave, he has good values. He's also extremely well-educated. He's well-versed in, I believe, over 20 languages, and he has obviously been able to be a significant contributor to many decades. And the fact is, he doesn't age, for reasons that I've been revealed here in this segment today on Galaxy Moonbeam Night Sight.
That's great, George. Well, we sure thank you for bringing us up to speed on Edgar Rice Burroughs and the Tarzan legacy. And again, we do recommend anybody who has any interest read the novel.
And the movies are great,
the movies
too.
Well.
The movies are wonderful. You know, as I said, it goes all the way back to the 1920s. You can now get them on DVD, including the famous television series that Ron Ely did in the 1960s. So, by all means, enjoy.
That's great. Well, thanks, George, for that great piece. We're going to take a little break here on Galaxy Moonbeam Night Sight with another retro commercial for you. So don't go away. We've got much, much more coming up. You're listening to Galaxy Moonbeam Night Sight on the Galaxy Nostalgia Network.
Here's a big record inspired by a top popularity star. Yes, it's Oldsmobile, today outselling 15 other major makes of American cars. And here's one of the big reasons: the brilliant 88 lowest priced rocket engine car. At a surprisingly low cost, the 88 gives you Oldsmobile's big car styling and big car comfort. And as standard equipment, the famous Rocket T400 engine with a four-barrel carburetor. Also, a safety steering wheel, turn signals, pedal parking brake, twin-lighted ashtrays, an extra big glove compartment, and many other luxury items, all at no extra cost. And now, right now, would be a smart time to see your authorized Oldsmobile quality dealer. Let him show you how very easy it is to go over to an Olds 88.
And welcome back to the Galaxy Moonbeam Night Sight program. I'm George Halalakos, along with my good friends Gilbert Smith, Mike Bragg, and Mike Zuccaro. We're going to now turn it over to Gilbert, who's going to talk about the centennial anniversary of an iconic food product. Take it away, Gilbert.
Thank you, George. Well, an American institution, the Oreo cookie, turned 100 in 2012. All of us baby boomers have grown up with the Oreos. We have many memories of eating the cookies from our early years, perhaps having them with a glass of milk at night or as an after-school snack. They've caused great disputes as to the best way to eat them, either dunking them in milk or twisting off one side and eating the middle first, or just simply taking a bite out of the entire cookie sandwich. Mike B., I'm curious. You look like an Oreo cookie kind of guy to me. What's your favorite way of eating an Oreo?
Crumbling them up over a good old-fashioned slice of meatloaf. Plenty of ketchup. Actually, I gave up Oreos back about 10 years ago, and I don't know if it was urban myth, but I bit. But when I found that the Oreo icing was nothing more than pure Crisco and some sugar.
Yeah.
Really?
Is that true?
It's true.
Oh.
It was. It was.
So much. So the meatloaf idea is not too bad then.
No, the meatloaf idea. But seriously, Mike, how do you like your Oreo cookies?
I'd get a big glass of ice-cold milk, load it up with Oreos, and squash them with a fork and make an Oreo. Ooh. They call them Oreo Jack in the Box. Now, there's a name for what I do.
Oh, the Oreo shake or Oreo kind of Oreo malt or something?
Blizzard? Not the Blizzard, but
that's a Dairy Queen
Dairy
product.
Queen product.
But they
yeah.
have that.
But
I
there's
have.
A
yeah.
crushed Oreo item that is for sale at Jack in the Box.
It's I know. Not,
and I'm going to sue them one day.
I know exactly what you're talking about. I love those at Jack in the Box.
Well, it gives
it's
you
an Oreo shake.
Oreo really shake, yeah. Crushed Oreo shake.
Really good.
And It's got the texture, it's got the flavor, it's got the sweetness, it's got the creaminess, all the food groups as far as I'm concerned.
And you're absolutely right. In the early days, it was just nothing more than basically Crisco and sugar, but they finally, they made it a little more healthier in recent years.
Okay.
Guys, George, Mike Z, how do you like your Oreos?
Oh, I would prefer my Oreos served up by Isabella Rossellini dressed up like a slave girl and saying, you want another Oreo cookie, Mike?
That's a novel way of looking at it.
That's a novel. Oh, everybody loves Oreo. I personally, I was never a milk guy. I always actually like them with iced tea or with a cup of coffee.
Oh,
but
you
whether you're an Oreo man or a Hydrox cookie man, whatever you are, man, those and Lorna Doones were two of my favorite cookies growing up. And pecan sandies.
Ah, there you go. There you go. George?
Well, I wanted to say that my memories of Oreo cookie, I like mine with lemonade, particularly in the summertime.
Ooh.
I like to have, after a hot summer day here in Southern California, it was fun to come in and to have a nice ice-cold glass of lemonade with Oreo cookies. And I like to just bite mine straight up. I don't like to fool around. No ritual of twisting it and eating the inside first.
Man.
I just go right to it. But I wanted to mention also that Oreos brings up an age-old debate, similar to a lot of other debates that we have about different things. And the question is, are you an Oreo person or a Hydrox person?
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out that in my house, my wife, Sharon, of 30 years, reminded me before we did this taping this morning, she goes, you be sure and tell everyone to remind them that I'm a Hydrox person. I like Hydrox. So it's kind of fun to see, you know, what people really, really like. I think they're both great myself.
They're both very good. And for the record, how I like to eat them is I'll take one and I'll just bite into it, and then I'll take another one and I'll split it in half and, you know, eat the frosting first, and then I'll take another one and, you know, and dunk it in a glass of milk or something.
I always wondered how you kept your boyish figure.
That's how I do it. That's the secret. Well, anyway, a little bit more on the history of Oreo. In 1898, several baking companies merged to form the National Biscuit Company, or Nabisco as it's widely known. They are the maker of Oreo cookies, of course. By 1902, Nabisco had created Barnum's Animal Crackers and made them famous by selling them in a little box designed like a cage with a string attached. I sure remember those when I was a little
kid.
Yeah. The purpose of the string was to hang the box on Christmas trees.
No way.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Yes.
Wow.
In 1912, Nabisco had a new idea for a cookie, two chocolate discs with a cream filling in between. It was known as the Oreo biscuit. And the first Oreo looked very similar to the Oreo cookie of today, with only a slight difference in the design of the chocolate cookie discs. The original design of the cookie featured a wreath around the edge of the cookie and the name Oreo in the center. And here in the United States, they were sold for 25 cents a pound in novelty cans with clear glass tops. In 1921, the Oreo biscuit was renamed the Oreo sandwich. And in 1924, a new design was introduced for the cookie. And then in 1948, the Oreo sandwich was renamed the Oreo cream sandwich, and it was changed again in 1974 to the Oreo chocolate sandwich cookie. The present-day Oreo design was developed in 1952 and includes the Nabisco logo. Now, here's something interesting. The origin of the name Oreo is really unknown, but there are many theories, including derivations from the French word or, meaning gold, because the early package was gold in color. Another theory is that the name comes from the Greek word oreo, meaning beautiful, nice, or well done.
Orea.
Orea, there you go. Still other theories say the name is a combination of taking the re from cream and placing it between the two O's in chocolate, making Oreo. And there are others who believe that the cookie was named Oreo simply because it was short and easy to pronounce. Anyway, whatever the case might be, over 362 billion Oreo cookies have been sold since they were first introduced in 1912, making them, again, as we mentioned earlier, the best-selling cookie of the 20th century. So happy centennial to the Oreo cookie, celebrating its 100th birthday in 2012. George.
Gilbert, I had two quick questions.
Sure.
Does the reference biscuit, is that a reference to, because I know that in England, to this day in the United Kingdom, that cookies are referred to as biscuits.
Biscuits, yeah.
That's question one. And question number two, off the topic a bit, but in the iconic film Wizard of Oz, when the soldiers there in the castle are marching, it seems like they're singing the song.
Oreo,
yo. Yes, it does.
So I was wondering, was that a commercial
a plug?
Sequence?
You know what? That never dawned on me. But you're right. No, as far as I know, it was not a commercial sequence. But yeah, it's they're basically singing an Oreo. I'm surprised that Nabisco never picked up on that and did it as a commercial. You figure that it would have been a wonderful commercial.
Well, yeah. I know one thing. When I used to watch The Wizard of Oz as a kid, that was a good time to, you know, at the next commercial to go and get some from the pantry.
There are cookies and there are biscuits. I guess in England they're the same, but they have entirely different meanings here because there's a dog biscuit, but a dog cookie is something you don't want to step on in your backyard late at night. It's funny how the language changed even in the English-speaking nations. But, you know, the Oreo biscuit, Sunshine Hydrox, they're still called biscuits.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting. Just because we're speaking English doesn't mean we're speaking the same language.
No. And I don't think that it really was in reference to, I'm guessing, George, I don't think it was really in reference to a connection with Great Britain, but remember that it was called the National Biscuit Company.
Yes.
So maybe they called it the Oreo Biscuit, which would have made sense.
And of course.
And then probably later on, the term cookie came in to be more.
What a great segment.
Well, thank you. I thought we would just mention that as some of you listeners who hopefully have heard some of our other shows, we are covering here in the last remaining weeks of 2012 some of the anniversary items that are happening, 100th anniversaries and 50th anniversaries and 40th anniversaries and so on and so forth. And we thought we would bring that to you about the Oreo cookie, really a perennial favorite for all us baby boomers. So glad you enjoyed that. Well, we're going to move on to our next segment. Now, you know, a while back we did actually two programs here on Galaxy Moonbeam Nightsight about the 100th anniversary, speaking of anniversaries, the 100th anniversary of the sinking of Titanic, and we got a great deal of positive response from you listeners. That really touches a chord, as we said then. Not exactly a baby boomer topic, but of great interest. And at that time, Mike Z had mentioned to us the idea of revisiting the topic of shipwrecks and doing a little segment on the Andrea Doria, which is also a very, very interesting and moving story. So on today's show, we're going to do that piece. We're going to turn it over to Mike Z, who's going to tell us all about this shipwreck of the Andrea Doria, which some of you out there probably remember. Maybe when a lot of you were little kids, probably remember hearing about that. Anyway, Mike Z, the Andrea Doria and the Stockholm.
Well, thank you, Gilbert. Appreciate this so much. You know, this is something I've wanted to do for quite a while, because the wreck of the Andrea Doria and the Stockholm, which were two cruise ships that collided on July 25th, 1956, off the coast of Long Island, actually New England, is an extremely interesting story. I think, to me personally, speaking for myself, it's every bit as intriguing as the wreck of the Titanic, and maybe even more so. There are a couple of reasons. First of all, it was the first, and I believe still the only, collision between two ocean liners in history. In 1963, an Israeli ship called the Shalom hit an oil tanker, but I think this was the only time the two cruise ships actually collided. And it was a great sea rescue. I mean, out of the 1,500 or so passengers that were on the Andrea Doria, 46 died and 5 people died on the Stockholm. But let me tell you a little bit about this, and you tell me if you think that this is not a story that needs to have a movie done about it, because there have already been a few books written about it. The ship was built in Genoa, Italy, and it was named after one of Italy's two great Italian explorers. Everyone knows Christopher Columbus, but Andrea Doria himself was not all that well known. He was born in 1466. He lived to 1560. And the ship was built by the Italia Line. I believe construction on it started in 1951 or 52. And this collision occurred on a very foggy night on July 25th of 1956. Like the Titanic, the Andrea Doria was considered pretty much unsinkable. It had a double bottom. It was all welded construction. And it was considered another one of these ships that it was just impossible to think that it would ever sink. On the night of the collision, however, there were 575 officers and crew, and there were, I believe, 1,290 passengers on the ship. They were coming back from Italy. The ship had actually left Italy, about 5 or 6 days before, and it was coming into port. It was one of the many ships at that time where each class was very rigidly divided. Each class, which would be luxury, tourist class, and so on, there were 3 of them, first, second, and third class, had its own dining room, had its own lounge, had its own movie theater, had its own swimming pool, even. It cost $30 million to build the ship and about another $30 million just for all the artwork that was on it. I've seen photographs of it. It was a beautiful-looking ship outside, and it was really elegantly appointed on the inside. No corners were cut outfitting the Andrea Doria. The captain was Captain Calamai. He was 58 years old. He had 39 years at sea, and he had 27 ships under him when he was in the Merchant Marine. He was no amateur. They left Genoa, Italy on July 17, 1956, and they went to Cannes, they went to Naples, they went to Gibraltar, and then straight into New York. They had 400 tons of freight on them, and they were cruising along pretty idly. They were expecting to get into New York on schedule that night. On that night, a thick fog descended, and coming in the opposite direction, leaving New York, heading west to east, was a Norwegian cruise ship called the Stockholm. The Stockholm had Captain Nordenson on the bridge. He was about 60 years old. He had 46 years at sea. Now, these two ships were coming together in zero visibility, pretty much, in a heavy fog. But these were modern ships. They both had radar, and they both were able to detect each other. The Stockholm picked up the Andrea Doria, I believe, at about 17 miles out. They were a few miles north-south of each other. In other words, they were separated by a few miles, and they were closing on each other at approximately 20 knots speed for the Andrea Doria, and slower than that, about 10 or 15 knots speed for the Stockholm. And this is where the story really gets interesting, because on the bridge of the Andrea Doria was the captain and his crew. On the bridge of the Stockholm was a pretty experienced crew, and they're both aware that each is coming to each other. They're separated by a safe distance, a few miles, and in fact, Captain Calamai pulls the Andrea Doria to his left to even increase the distance a few degrees. As they're coming about a mile or two apart, even through this dense fog, they could start to see the lights of each ship. And they would have passed absolutely safely, but for the fact that at the last moment, no more than a mile away, the captain of the Stockholm orders his ship to pull to the right. And it puts him on a dead collision course with the Andrea Doria. The Andrea Doria sees the Stockholm coming to him. There's nothing they can really do. They pull a hard left to try to minimize the accident they know is going to happen. And the Andrea Doria is cut with a huge gaping hole by the Stockholm, the bow of the Stockholm. The Stockholm was actually designed to cut through heavy Norwegian ice and so on that it would have run into. So it does some severe damage. Could have been a real catastrophe, but for the fact that the lives of the people on that ship were saved by the fact that they were in excellent radio contact, and there was a ship called the Ile-de-France. Now, the Ile-de-France got an SOS call that was being sent out by the Andrea Doria, and it was at that time about 2 hours away, but it was a huge French cruise ship, and the passengers on the Andrea Doria are saved largely by the actions of the captain, Captain Baron Raoul de Baudin, I think I'm saying it right, who decided to turn the Ile-de-France around, and along with a number of other ships, smaller ships that came to the rescue, everyone on the Andrea Doria is saved. In fact, many people from the Andrea Doria were even able to get onto the Stockholm. The Stockholm itself sent out lifeboats, and even though the Stockholm was badly damaged, it was able to limp back into port. Not so for the Doria, though. The Andrea Doria sank the next day. It was the flagship of the Italian line. It was just a beautiful ship, and there was, of course, an investigation into all of this. And ultimately, the investigation, which ran into 1957, somehow concluded that both captains were at fault. Both ships were traveling pretty fast in a fog. Technically, they were both out quite a bit distance out of the normal sea lanes, but I think the main cause of the accident, and this is just me having read as much as I could, was that I think that the captain of the Stockholm had his radar set on the wrong range, and he thought that the Andrea Doria was about three times away further than it was at the moment that he ordered the turn, because at the time he ordered the turn, the Andrea Doria was just coming into view visually, just with lights, and it was too late. And there is a pop culture tie-in on this also. on that ship was Mike Stoller. Who's Mike Stoller? Well, Mike Stoller is half of Lieber and Stoller, the songwriting team who wrote so many big hits in the 50s and 60s. We could do a show on them alone. He and Jerry Lieber had just written an awful song called Black Denim Trousers and Motorcycle Boots by a group called The Cheers, and it was a huge hit. They made so much money off the royalties on that, he and his wife and kids decided to take a three-month European vacation. And if you ever get a chance to read Mike Stoller, Jerry and Mike's biography, which is called Hound Dog, which is one of the tunes they wrote, he talks about this. He remembered the night quite vividly, having to go back down to his stateroom, having to fight people to get life jackets, having to get back on the bridge, and then to compound the felony, literally the felony, as they're trying to get off the ship, they realize that some of the first people off the ship were some of the crew of the Andrea Doria. Though most of the crew stuck around. But this was a real bone of contention, because according to Mike and many other people on the ship, at the time of the accident, there were no announcements made by the captain except stay calm. And after that, it was pretty much everyone for themselves. Only half of the lifeboats were usable, because the Andrea Doria almost immediately starts to list about 20 degrees, which meant that the lifeboats on the left-hand side of the boat were pretty much unusable. If it tilted more than about 15, they would have hit the ship coming down. It was 20 degrees, so they only had the lifeboats on the right-hand side to use. But luckily, the ship stayed afloat till the next morning, and plenty of time for everyone to get off. It's a fascinating accident, because it seemed to have been so completely, completely preventable. One more interesting tidbit. A dozen more people died going down to the Andrea Doria trying to rescue things from it. You know, guys go down to these ships and try to get little artifacts and plates and dishes and so on. 12 people lost their lives in the ensuing years going down to the Andrea Doria. The first trip down to the Andrea Doria was the next day. Pete Gimbel, who was the heir to the Gimbel's department store fortune in New York, goes down there with a photographer by the name of Dave Fox, snaps some pictures, and it gets into Life magazine the next week. But endlessly, endlessly fascinating story about the Doria. And if you want to learn more about it, there are a few books. The one that I use was Saved by Bill Hoffer. There is another very good book just written about the rescue called Deep Descent by Kevin Murphy. And if you want to look into it a bit further, there's one that I do not have by Alvin Moscow called Collision Course, the Andrea Doria and the Stockholm. I don't know. To me, it's one of the most interesting sea rescue stories in history, and I just want to know what you guys would like to contribute. I'm sorry I rambled on a bit, but it was just something
Mike,
I wanted to do for a long time.
No, that's fine, and that was a great synopsis of it. I think what pulled me out of the water, no pun intended, about this whole situation is that here's two ships that are equipped with radar.
Modern ships,
radio communication,
yep.
And this happened,
and it was just, I still think that radar was set to the wrong range, because as soon as he made that turn, the fate was sealed. Had he just not made that turn, had the captain of the Stockholm stayed on her course, those ships would have passed about a mile apart.
Did they make a determination that the captain of the Stockholm was at fault? Did they ever make a final determination on that?
There was a big investigation, and they both, and the insurance companies and the owners of the ships ultimately settled, I think, out of court, and I think they probably ultimately realized that both captains were to a degree at fault. But I don't see how the captain of the Stockholm could not have been fully at fault. Mike, did you want to say something?
Yeah, when we review these events in history, there's always some correlation or an intersection or in some cases a coincidence. The Andrea Doria story is interesting because we talk about pop culture and broadcasting and the history of communication. Ruth Roman was a very popular actress in the 1950s. And she and her child, her son, were on the Andrea Doria. Ruth Roman in 1950 made a movie called Three Secrets, in which she played a distraught mother who was waiting to learn whether or not her child had survived a plane crash in which a lot of people were killed. Fast forward 7 years, 1957, the same Ruth Roman and her child are passengers on the Andrea Doria.
Very true.
And they're separated during the sinking. And she spent countless hours distraught, just like in the movie, wondering if her daughter, or actually her son in this case, her son was lost. He was actually one of the survivors, and he did make it through. But that is an interesting coincidence, as with, we talk about broadcasting, there was an ABC radio network news commentator, Gilbert will know the name, Edward P. Morgan.
Edward Morgan,
sure, absolutely, yeah.
And he's based in New York City, and he broke the first broadcast. he broke the broadcast, a very professional, award-winning account of the collision, never telling his listeners during the broadcast that he had a 14-year-old daughter aboard the Andrea Doria, and she was feared dead. During his broadcast, he knew this. He did not know that Linda Morgan would later be labeled the Miracle Girl because she was alive and aboard Stockholm. Afterward, the following night after learning the good news, his emotional broadcast became one of the more memorable breaking news stories in radio news history.
Yeah, he was told for certain by an eyewitness who was a doctor,
yes,
that he had seen his wife, yep, and the little girl killed. What actually happened, the little girl was thrown. I believe she was the one who was thrown,
yes,
from the Andrea Doria into the demolished bow of the Stockholm,
yep,
and found by the crewmen of the Stockholm, and he was told, yep, that she was dead. And the next day, he gets a call. We've got this girl. We don't know who she is, and it turns out that that's his daughter. I mean, what a story, right?
Yeah.
Why was there not a movie made about this film? Gil, you want to say something? Please do, sir.
Well, I was going to mention that if you look at the Critics' Choice video catalog, they actually now have a DVD that is now available for purchase, which provides an account of what happened with the Andrea Doria. And it may, in fact, include the broadcast that Mike Bragg mentioned, but it's a whole collection of stories and everything related to that. And so it's a documentary program that is available on DVD. So while it's not been made into a film story, that is certainly available to people that might want to augment the excellent reading selection that you gave. There was two other points that I wanted to share that are unrelated, but from a classic film trivia perspective, and members of our audience would love to hear this, that the Andrea Doria itself, the real ship, can actually be found on one major film. Happens to be the 1954 film On the Waterfront, featuring Marlon Brando, Eva Marie Saint, and it was the best picture of that year. And you can actually see the Andrea Doria sailing out of New York Harbor.
Wow.
The character played by Marlon Brando, Terry Molloy, is standing there on the dock watching it sail by. So if you, wow, the next time you look at the film On the Waterfront, be on the lookout to see the actual ship, the Andrea Doria, captured on film. The second item that I wanted to mention, and it's very interesting because this parallels what we covered on Titanic, and that is that this was the last major transatlantic maritime disaster. Then it also marked the end of an important era because at that time there was a shift away from cruise lines as the preferred means of travel to airlines because Boeing had introduced its 707,
yep,
jet aircraft,
yep,
that made transatlantic travel far more easier and feasible. And so you can actually say that this event marks the end of an era, just like we associate the Titanic marking the end of the Edwardian era.
Yep, good point.
That's a very good point, George.
We also talk about automotive pop culture and an interesting little tidbit in wrapping up this story of the Andrea Doria. The Chrysler Motor Car Company was very concerned because Chevrolet had introduced the Corvette in 1953. Ford came out with the Thunderbird, while Chrysler was left empty as far as an American sports car. So they had a sports car designed in Italy by the Ghia Company, in a very popular Italian car maker. The Ghia Company, and it was a one-of prototype car, one in the world, one made. It was in the 50-car garage of the Andrea Doria, and it went down, and there was no attempt to recover it because the Chrysler guys at the top said, we will never sell this car given the history of the prototype. But it was years before Chrysler came out with a sports car model after,
yep,
that.
Hard to believe. At least they know where it is.
It was called the Chrysler Norseman, by the way.
Are the designs,
Stockholm Norseman.
Are the designs available,
wow,
to see? Are they anywhere?
I don't know.
That's an interesting question, but that definitely was in there. So I don't know, Gilbert, isn't it a fascinating story?
Fascinating story, Mike. I mean, I think that shipwrecks in general appeal to most people. There's just something. Look at the response we got from our Titanic shows. There's just something that, I guess, captures the imagination.
I think it's the fact that it's a small community that's on board the ship.
Yeah.
I mean, in the case of Titanic,
yeah,
an entire small town was lost.
Exactly.
And And we can say that conversely, with the Andrea Doria, a small town was saved.
True. Mm-hmm. If you ever want to read the individual stories of so many of the passengers, by all means, get Saved, the book that I use, yes. Bill Hoffer. I've had this for many, many years, and he tracked down many of the survivors. I think this was published in 1977 or 1979. You could probably easily find it on Amazon for a nickel or a dime, right, or something like that, 1979. And he tracked down so many of the survivors, and they all have such interesting stories to tell. I still think it'd be a great movie. It ties in the 1950s. It ties in shipwrecks. It ties in a lot of human interest. I don't know. I think that someone's missing a bet. And I'd be willing to make a small wager that 99.9% of the people under the age of 60, in other words, people who don't remember it, don't even know it ever happened.
That's true, because I think it's been obscured by Titanic.
Absolutely.
And things like that. I would imagine that there's still, Mike, a good number of survivors that are still living.
Well, probably. I mean, certainly some of the
younger
people,
ones.
Some of the, because otherwise these people will be coming up on 80 and
right.
90 now. But I don't know how many survivors still are around, and I would be willing to bet, and I did not do it, that there is probably some type of a survivors group, survivors association, or someone, some organization that is keeping track of the survivors of the Andrea Doria wreck.
Exactly, because I know that the Titanic had quite a formal organization of survivors,
yep,
and I think they've all passed away now.
Yep.
But certainly there should be some kind of a group like that for the Andrea Doria survivors.
I would think so. I'm not aware. I mean, I didn't really research that. I mostly wanted to research
sure. The
history of it. But that's my story, and I'm sticking to it. I hope it turns somebody out there, somebody, into a bit of a fan of this to learn a little bit more about it. Who knows? Maybe more will come of it. Endlessly fascinating story for my little walnut-sized dog brain.
Well, you know what, Mike? It's a great piece, and hopefully somebody will make a movie.
It deserves
a movie of
it. There are many good subjects. That's just one of them. It deserves it.
Absolutely.
And Mike Z, that's a wonderful piece. Good coverage. And Mike Z, by the way, is the host and originator of Saturday Night Sock Hop, that plays live music here on AM radio in San Diego. And one quick observation: what would have happened? No Lieber and Stoller.
Well,
had Stoller gone down with the ship, hundreds of tunes would not have been created.
Such prolific songwriters, and to break up that team in 1956, just about near the beginning of their ridiculously fruitful and productive relationship, would have had quite an effect on popular music and rock and roll. I mean, they were so prolific in what they wrote. If anybody's interested, get Hound Dog. That's their biography. I've got it. It's one of the books that made it into the headboard of my bed. And we would have lost one of the greats, one of the true great songwriters, had he gone down with that ship.
Again, good work, and it probably something that a lot of people that write into us, Smitty, say, I didn't know that. My mom and dad had talked about something way back then, and it never occurred to me until you guys brought it up on the show. So
we
hope we're contributing, keeping the pop culture alive here at Galaxy Moonbeam Nightside on the Galaxy Nostalgia Network. We're going to go to a retromercial here, and when we come back, we are going to finish up with this one-hour-long episode here at Galaxy Moonbeam Nightside. Don't go away.
Oh, 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 my best friend and an Oreo cookie. She loves the crunchy chocolate. I like the creamy middle. Been eating them this way since we were very little. We'll always be friends with O-R-E-O. Friends are better when you pair them. Oreos are better when you share them.
Oreo cookies. Share them.
Well, I tell you what we're going to share. We're going to share about another 15 minutes or so, maybe a little less than that, with my buddy Mike Bragg and George Halalakos and Gilbert Smith, because you are listening to the Galaxy Moonbeam Show. What do we have queued up here next on the old Presto disc recording machine? What's the next segment, Gilbert?
Well, we're going to talk. Thanks, Mike. We're going to talk a little bit about another anniversary that we're celebrating this year. We're mentioning some of the anniversaries that are ending on the even year or the five year, but we have the 50th anniversary of the Incredible Hulk. In this year of 2012, we marked the 50th anniversary of a comic book character and the resulting series he was featured in, the Incredible Hulk, who is a fictional character, a superhero, who appears in comic books published by Marvel Comics. Created by Stan Lee and Jack Kirby, the character first appeared in The Incredible Hulk number 1 in May of 1962. He's a gigantic, green, irradiated, mutated, humanoid monster, sounds like somebody I know, with incredible strength and an inability to control his rage. The Hulk is sometimes characterized as a hyper-aggressive, and brutal individual, while other times as cunning, brilliant, and scheming. He's often portrayed as an anti-hero. The Hulk is cast as the emotional and impulsive alter ego of the withdrawn and reserved physicist Dr. Robert Bruce Banner. Banner first transforms into the Hulk shortly after he is accidentally exposed to the blast of a gamma bomb he invented. Subsequently, Banner will involuntarily transform into the Hulk whenever he gets too angry or if his life is in danger, leading to extreme complications in Banner's life. Stan Lee said that the Hulk's creation was inspired by a combination of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde and Frankenstein. Now, in the debut, Lee chose gray for the Hulk because he wanted a color that did not suggest any particular ethnic group. Colorist Stan Goldberg, however, had problems with the gray coloring, resulting in different shades of gray in that issue. And after seeing the first published issue, Lee chose to change the skin color to green. Green was used in retellings of the origin, with even reprints of the original story being recolored for the next two decades until The Incredible Hulk Volume 2 from December 1984 reintroduced the Gray Hulk in flashback set close to the origin story. Since then, reprints of the first issue have displayed the original gray coloring, with the fictional canon specifying that Hulk's skin had initially been gray and later turned green. The original series was canceled with Issue 6 in March of 1963. Stan Lee had written each story, with Kirby penciling the first five issues and Steve Ditko penciling and inking the sixth. Around this time, co-creator Kirby received a letter from a college dormitory stating that the Hulk had been chosen as its official mascot. At that point, Kirby and Lee realized their character had found an audience in college-age readers. The Hulk possesses the potential for limitless physical strength, depending directly on his emotional state, particularly his anger. This has been reflected in the repeated comment, "The madder Hulk gets, the stronger Hulk gets." After probing, the entity Beyonder once claimed that the Hulk's potential strength had no finite element inside. His durability, regeneration, and endurance also increases in proportion to his temper. Hulk has been described as having a level of physical power where Hulk was stronger than any mortal and most immortals who ever walked the earth. The Hulk is resistant to most forms of injury or damage. The extent varies between interpretations, but he has withstood the equivalent of solar temperatures, nuclear explosions, and planet-shattering impacts. And despite his remarkable resiliency, continuous barrages of high-caliber gunfire can hinder his movement to some degree, and this has been constantly portrayed outside the comic books in both live-action films and animation. In the Avengers film, he is able to momentarily withstand a sustained barrage of fire from a fighter aircraft. He has been shown to have both regenerative and adaptive healing abilities, including growing tissues to allow him to breathe underwater, surviving unprotected in space for extended periods, and when injured, healing from most wounds within seconds. As an effect, he has an extremely prolonged lifespan. The Hulk has been depicted in various other media, most notably by the late Bill Bixby, as Dr. David Banner and Lou Ferrigno as the Hulk in the live-action television series and made-for-television movies. Other depictions include multiple animated series and various video games. And The Incredible Hulk, 50 years old. Guys, are you Hulk fans?
I like the Hulk, and I'm particularly a fan of Lou Ferrigno. I've seen him on a number of sports programs, notably, I remember originally on ABC's Wide World of Sports, and then more recently on some of the ESPN sports programs. And Mr. Ferrigno is still a man of great physical prowess. You see him engage in a lot of the activities that made him famous and that allowed him to get this coveted role. And when you see him in real life, it gives you the image of a gentle giant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
so I'm a big fan, and I particularly enjoyed the way in which it was portrayed in the series with Mr. Bixby. Mm-hmm. I thought that Ferrigno and Bixby really complemented each other so very well,
yeah.
And I thought it was a great example on the ability to translate successful comic book hero into live action, something that's very difficult.
Absolutely, and I imagine that some of those early comic books are probably pretty collectible, aren't they, Mike Bragg?
Oh, sure, anything in that era. It's coming along. That's probably one of the sleepers. If you want to get in early and get in cheap, you might want to look at that type of genre, that TV show, specialty TV show that was spun off of a comic series, and go with that. Of course, there's Lou Ferrigno comic books or Lou Ferrigno bodybuilder magazines that are very popular now for collectible items. I was actually a fan of Bill Bixby. his work with my favorite Martian, with Ray Walston, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. and then he almost took an opposite role in Courtship of Eddie's
yes.
Father. I think he has some versatility, and I believe that he's passed away.
Yes, he has.
Gone away, along with Ray Walston, and Lou Ferrigno's still with us, though, right?
Lou Ferrigno's yeah. still with us. Remember a show that Bill Bixby did, I believe it was called The Magician?
The Magician.
Yes, I love that. I remember that show, too. Yes.
That was a heartbreaker when that left. I think that was a CBS, but
I think it was an NBC.
NBC. Oh, it was an NBC.
I'll tell you why.
Because it was on the Wednesday night.
Yes. I remember. Yeah, wasn't it part of the rotating mystery movies with Columbo?
Mystery franchise.
I remember Mike Z. The opening, you know, they were playing the theme music, and the announcer would say something along the lines of, all the tricks you're going to see are performed by Bill Bixby as the magician.
Something like that.
So, yeah, you're right, the magician.
Wonderful memories.
Yes, wonderful. Well, speaking of wonderful memories, I'm going to bring George into the conversation here. And we recently, in the last several months, lost a good friend, George and I did. Actually, in George's case, not only a good friend, but a godbrother. We want to spend a few minutes remembering our friend Chris Limbesis.
Well, Christy Limbesis, as you noted, Gilbert, a special friend and extended member of the Galaxy Nostalgia Network family. He passed away on September 6th
of this year.
And Chris was born on August 14th of 1944. He was the eldest son of Chris and Georgia Limbesis of Long Beach, California, who were my godparents. And we remember Christy today because his life's journey was a reflection of the depth and the breadth of the baby boomer generation, which is our target audience for this program. And when we look at his life's journey, we see that he embodied so many of the varied characteristics and achievements that we associate with this generation. Chris was a decorated member of the United States Army. He was a design engineer for the aerospace industry, a distinguished old-time radio historian, a professional sound restoration engineer, a hobbyist, a published author, and a collector. And of particular interest to the Galaxy Moonbeam Nightside audience, at one time, Christie owned the entire collection of Edgar Riseborough's books on a first edition basis, including all 24 books of the Tarzan series that we profiled earlier in this program, as well as the John Carter Martian series, which was recently introduced by Disney on the big screen. And Christie's lifetime work with old-time radio, including the restoration and curator-related tasks that enabled him to get to know some of the major contributors both on film and radio, as well as his being a teacher in the Orange County, California Community College system, enabled him to build a collection that eventually exceeded 10,000 shows. And he was also the co-author of two books on two popular radio programs, Quiet Please and Dragnet. Chris was a really unique individual, and I wanted to share with all of you that I have in my collection an interview that he did with Hulbert Burroughs, who was the eldest son of Edgar Rice Burroughs. This interview was done in September of 1967, ironically about 45 years prior to Christie's passing. And in it, Chris and his father, my late godfather, they interviewed Mr. Burroughs, and they talked about many of the topics that we briefly touched upon in today's earlier program. So I'm so pleased to have that as a special memory. And I think it's interesting because Christie had a part in bringing us together, I believe, Gilbert.
Yeah, that's right, George. When we first made contact last year, a little over a year ago, and we were talking, and I believe you mentioned Chris Limbesis, and I go, well, I know a Chris Limbesis. It's got to be the same guy. And amazingly enough, it was. And I had met Chris probably sometime over 20 years ago, and I met Chris through the old-time radio conventions that I used to go to up in the Los Angeles area. And Chris was always there, usually selling books and selling memorabilia materials, and got to know him and eventually saw some of the work that he did. I remember going to his apartment, a rather Spartan apartment, but there was a big table with the turntable, all of his equipment to clean these transcription discs. And he was very meticulous about cleaning the transcription discs in order so that they could be remastered and you could get the cleanest sound possible. He'd go through and cut out all the clicks and pops and did a lot of the commercially now the commercially released CD compilations that are out, if you look at some of the ones that are out there, and along with another friend who I met through Chris, Jerry Burling, up in Long Beach, both Chris and Jerry worked on these shows, just making those old discs sound like they were brand new. Very meticulous, very oriented, very detail-oriented, someone very, very knowledgeable. I found it interesting after he passed away that I was talking with George, and George filled me in on his military career and all the things that he had done. And interestingly enough, Chris had never mentioned those things to me, and I think we were talking, George, that was part of his humble side. He wouldn't bring any of this out.
He was such a humble person. He knew the likes of Jack Benny,
right.
Bob Hope, Fred Allen, Vincent Price, so many great people. In fact, he was almost understated. I remember that there was an incident where he was doing some work for Vincent Price, and he said to his mother, my godmother, Georgia Limbesis, he says, Mom, he said, Vincent Price is coming by later this afternoon to pick up some work that I did for him. And he said it in such a matter-of-fact way that she didn't believe him. She goes, oh, fine, Christy, just send him to, you know, to come in through the back door. And it was so funny because he actually did that. Mr. Price showed up in his limousine, and he was escorted by Christy along the side of the house, coming through the back door. And I remember that probably for one of the few times in her life, my godmother was speechless because Vincent Price, in that trademark voice, said, hello, Mrs. Limbesis. And it was just so funny. And Christy was like that. He was a man of dignity, of honor, integrity, and he will be greatly missed. So many of the programs, both audio as well as video, that our Galaxy Moonbeam Nightsight audience enjoys is a result of the curator and restoration work that he has done over the last 40 years. And I know that he enjoyed, in the last few months of his life, listening to the recordings of this program. In fact, he had planned at some point to want to be a guest on this program, and while he wasn't able to do that, we can take comfort in the fact that the legacy of his work lives on, and it's a great pleasure to remember him here today. May his memory be eternal.
Absolutely, George. We remember Chris Limbesis and wanted to share that with all of our friends out there.
Well, you know what? We are out of time. I got so involved in listening to this. I'm really proud of this episode because we covered a whole different lineup. We went all over the pop culture spectrum and, of course, ending up with the loss of our good local friend Chris. We would like to thank you for listening into the last hour of this show. This is Galaxy Moonbeam Nightsight here on the Galaxy Nostalgia Network, and we want to remind you that you can always get these shows downloaded and passed along to friends or listen to them again and again if you'd like. You can catch those shows at Apple iTunes Store. You just type in Baby Boomer Radio in the search line. You're going to come right up to Galaxy Nostalgia Network. We have over 100 shows, and you can download and listen to every one of them to your heart's content. Send them around. We've noticed a jump in our listenership, mainly because of you, our current listeners, and your help with getting the word out about what we're doing here. In fact, if you do have ideas or suggestions for a future segment or future show, shoot us an email at galaxymoonbeamnightsight@gmail.com. Galaxy Moonbeam Nightsight, remember, that's S-I-T-E. @gmail.com. We're also on Facebook. We'd love you to come over and visit our Facebook site and like us. And I guess that's it for now. I'm Mike.
I'm Smitty.
I'm George.
I'm Mike Z, and I'm a Captain Calamai. It was not of my fault. I was driving straight. All of a sudden, she turned in front of me and make a big boom.
I thought you were driving the Israeli ship. What did you see, the stop sign or what?
I just had a little drink of wine, that's all.
Oh, you snuck.
No, I want a new job. I don't like this at all.
Ah, come sail away, come sail away with me.
You'll save money.
Okay. Bye-bye, booby.
This is the Galaxy Nostalgia Network.